Cairo, Seattle.
I'm Rachel Bell, and this is Your Last Meal, a show about famous people and the stories behind the foods they love most. Today on the program, John Hodgman. I'm doing jazz hands. John is an author, comedian, actor, and host of the highly entertaining podcast, Judge John Hodgman. We put in a little gavel sound right there. Can't afford anything else, but we can get that. No songs, just a gavel. You may know John as the PC in Apple's Get a Mac campaign, or you may have seen him as a correspondent on The Daily Show. John Hodgman's latest book, Vacationland, is out now in paperback.
And that paperback is perfect for summer reading. It's cheap. It's bendable. You can shove it in your luggage. You can drop it in a lake. You can leave it behind on an airplane. That's what it's there to do. Go out and just destroy that book, everybody. But please buy it, for sure.
John is also famous for a culinary debate that he has argued many, many times at the request of many, many people. A debate that he cannot escape because America does not want to let it go. A debate entitled, Is a Hot Dog a Sandwich? So this question has basically become like Your Baby Got Back. Sir Mix-a-Lot has to play it every time he performs, and now you have to hot dog it up every day.
Boy, oh boy. You know, I could think of worse lives to lead than being asked to talk about the sandwichness or non-sandwichness of hot dogs. And if it were as huge a hit as Baby Got Back, I would be a very happy man. And as it is, I am a very happy man.
Now, John's last meal is not an egg. But his passion for egg cookery inspired the direction of this episode. I chat with Rachel Kong, author of The Lucky Peach Book, all about eggs, about why and when eggs primarily became a breakfast food and why they're so ubiquitous around the globe. We'll also be using the word ubiquitous a lot in this episode because we can't afford a thesaurus. Ooh, and then producer Aaron and I take a field trip to Beth's Cafe, Seattle's iconic 64-year-old 24-hour diner. We attempt to take down one of their famous, massive 12-egg omelets. An omelet so big that Man vs. Food's Adam Richman couldn't even finish it. I think I'm going to call it.
I'm going for a clean plate.
Okay, now I'm going to finish.
Well, let's go big or go home, right?
All right. I'll be sad if you finish and I don't. I'm going to finish.
All right.
Okay. Stick around and see how that went. But first, my interview with John Hodgman. So you have written many books, including your latest, Vacationland, now out on paperback, and you've been on so many TV shows and you host a successful podcast. But when I'm looking around online, and maybe this is because I'm looking at you and food, it seems like your career really narrows down to a single question, which is a hot dog a sandwich? This seems to be the big question in your life.
It really haunts me almost every day, online and in person. So I do host a podcast called the Judge John Hodgman Podcast, available at MaximumFun.org or anywhere you get your podcasts, in which I mediate disputes, real-life disputes, between actual people who call in. And one of the disputes was a write-in dispute. Two guys were having a fight over whether or not a hot dog counts as a sandwich. And this is one of those questions that really put me right on my heels. Like, I remember very distinctly being on an airplane, thinking about what I was going to rule, and the answer was not simple. Because on, if I may say, a gut level, there is some distinction between hot dogness and sandwichness. And yet, how could I say that a hot dog was not a sandwich when it is, as so many people on Twitter have pointed out to me, nothing but meat in a bread loaf, much like a sub or a hero or a wedge sandwich. All of those things we would call a sandwich. So I had to come up for me with a falsifier, as they say in logical parlance, something that would disqualify the hot dog from sandwichness. And if I couldn't, then I would call it a sandwich. And if I could, then I would make the case that I do, that it is not a sandwich because, unlike anything else you might describe as a sandwich, you would not cut a hot dog in half unless you were extremely eccentric or catering to a very picky child.
What do people say when you give them your verdict?
I would term the kind of feedback I have received on this as endless and unceasing. And really about 50% support and very, very angry dissent. And in fact, you know, I ended up having a public debate on this subject with Dan Pashman, the host of a different podcast called The Sporkful in Gowanus, Brooklyn, where I live. He took the hot dog is a sandwich argument and made all of the tendentious, boring arguments that you would hear, like, oh, it used to be on menus as a hot dog sandwich, and also, what else could it be if not, fillings between two starch-related products, and all of that is meaningless to me. I won the debate, if not with my cut-in-half argument, but as well, the fact that you could extend the definition of sandwich to include a hot dog, obviously, but if you do, you're almost including anything as a sandwich. As I brought it up with Stephen Colbert on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, would you call a taco a sandwich? Of course not. Taco comes from a completely different food culture and cultural culinary etymology than the hot dog. To call a taco a sandwich would be the grossest culinary cultural appropriation. And the hot dog is the same thing. It comes from a different food tradition. It comes from a Germanic food tradition as opposed to an Anglo food tradition.
So this question has basically become like your baby got back. Like Sir Mix-a-Lot has to play it every time he performs, and now you have to hot dog it up every day.
Boy, oh boy. You know, I could think of worse lives to lead than being asked to talk about the sandwichness or non-sandwichness of hot dogs. And if it were as huge a hit as Baby Got Back, I would be a very happy man. And as it is, I am a very happy man.
And rich with hot dogs, no doubt.
Well, let's just say a major hot dog brand, having seen me have these fights on Twitter, did reach out and say, we would like to send you something. And what I did not realize was that they were going to send me not something, but some things, meaning dozens and dozens and dozens of hot dogs. More hot dogs that I could ever want to eat in a year. And it was a very strange thing in my apartment building to receive this huge, I mean, it was very generous of them, but I received this huge refrigerated package. And then having basically to go door to door in my apartment building, giving out packs of hot dogs to sort of spread the wealth, because there was no way I don't even think I could fit them all in my freezer.
Well, can I ask you, yeah. I'm sure people do this to you all the time, but I have my own question for you that is food related, which is a cheesecake a cake? Because it has cake in the name, but to me it doesn't seem very cake-like because it doesn't have a fluffy crumb. So I always have wondered if a cheesecake really is a cake, and if not, what is it?
Yeah, I was going to say the controversy around the cheesecake is the lack of a crumb. And certainly it's not, as they would say on the Great British Baking Show, it's not a sponge.
I love that.
It's more of an extremely dense, cheesy pudding on top of a kind of graham cracker crust. And a lot of people would argue that it has more in common with a pie for that reason, like a key lime pie, for example. But I would say that if a cake of soap is a cake, then a cheesecake can be a cake. It has a kind of dense, molded, cakey shape that speaks to the other definition of cake rather than the edible cake, than the definition of a dense loaf of something.
Like a urinal cake.
For example, that's the other one I was looking for. Well done.
Thank you. I always like to bring, you know, urine into talks about food. It's one of my specialties.
And I am embarrassed. I should have remembered that because, of course, I keep a mini Junior's cheesecake in my toilet at all times for freshness.
I read that you said that you could make eggs all day long if you could. You said scrambled, omelets, over easy, poached. I can do them all. Do you love
eggs? No, I hope I did not claim that I could do poached. That is the egg preparation that escapes me still, though I wish to get it right at one point. But that takes a lot of practice to really get down a poached egg without using a mold of any kind. Everything else I'm very, very good at. I'm not bragging to say this. I'm just being accurate. I can fry an egg like crazy. I can scramble eggs really well in a couple of different ways and textures, shall we say. That sounds gross now. But yeah, no, I love making eggs. I found, you know, there is a great food book called Eat Me by Kenny Shopson. Kenny is the notoriously foul-mouthed food philosopher who runs Shopson's General Store in the Essex Street Market here in New York City, although it was previously in the West Village, and a very eccentric thinker about food and very voluble maker of food, and also one of the first sort of New York food personalities who had rules such as no more than four people to a table, no cell phones, and also don't ever write about my restaurant because I don't want people to come. He finally broke his own rule with that by writing about the restaurant and his experience raising five children in the store, basically. It's an amazing book. And he really talked about eggs in the way that first resonated deeply with me, about the making of an egg is a philosophical experience. You are taking one of the messiest, gloopiest things as pure chaos, and putting it to the heat and creating something beautiful and ordered and stately out of it. That really impressed me very much. And since then, I try to find an excuse to make a scrambled egg every day, if not every hour.
So in the culinary world, scrambled eggs come up a lot because some people like this creamy, soft curd.
Yeah. We should start a cheese-making podcast called Curd Your Enthusiasm.
Oh, we should.
Yes.
So is scrambled egg your favorite? And how do you like them cooked specifically? What is your perfect scrambled egg?
I think the best scrambled egg I ever had in my life was the leftover scrambled egg that was rejected by Zazie Lambert Shopson, made for her, a child, by Melinda Shopson, Kenny's daughter, when I went over to their house one day. And Melinda made a scrambled egg by taking a cast iron skillet, just taking a whole stick of butter in the foil wrapping, unwrapping the end, and just putting it onto the hot pan until there was a lot of butter in there. And then just very quickly and unfussily, letting the butter get hot until it stopped foaming, pouring in the egg, and then immediately swirling it up. I think she used a chopstick, and I've used that too since. None of this double boiler, really low temperature, trying to create these perfect little sort of pea-shaped curds. I find all of that to be a little bit fussy compared to the beauty of the scrambled egg, that it was firm but yielding, extremely creamy, even though it had no cream or milk in it at all, because there was just a lot of butter in there. Salt and pepper, and you're off to the races, especially if it has a nice, really yellow yolk from those really fresh eggs that you can get sometimes and more often these days at farmers markets and stuff. There's something really special about that to me, and it was something that was offered very, it's children's food. And as the great chef and Fergus Henderson wrote, he's the guy in England who had the restaurant St. John that basically brought roasted bone marrow back from history and made it a staple of every menu in the world. He talks about scrambled eggs being very fortifying and steadying. And I find that's true. In a wobbly world, having a plate of hot scrambled eggs is comforting and gives you strength.
He has a point. An egg can be comforting. It can bring you strength. But in the form of a 12-egg omelet stuffed with ham, bacon, cheddar, and scallions, eggs can be the enemy of energy, as producer Aaron and I found out when we attempted to eat a dozen egg omelet at Beth's Diner. We're going to get to that after the break, and for once, we're going to make you really wait to see what John Hodgman's last meal is. That's going to come in the third act of the show. We're going to take a break right now, but when we come back, two pigs, 12 eggs. And we're the pigs.
Oink, oink.
How cute. Welcome to Beth's Cafe, the 64-year-old greasy spoon diner along Highway 99 in North Seattle. Now, as soon as you walk in the door of Beth's, you come face-to-face with an open kitchen and a big flat-top grill. And at all hours of day and night, this grill is covered with eggs in various stages of cookery, dinner plate-sized pancakes, and huge swaths of browning hash browns. And then when you walk into the dining areas, every last inch of wall space is covered with crayon drawings done by customers, adults and children alike. People are given sheets of white paper and a basket of crayons to occupy their time while they wait for their breakfasts.
I really like the drawings that are hanging up on the wall, Beth. They're littered everywhere, and you get such a range of artistic ability. Some people, it's just kid scrawlings, but then there are other people who are really talented artists and
totally.
Put up these beautiful pictures. So it's cool to see all that.
Some are sober artists, some are drunk artists, because Beth transforms after the sun goes down into a drunken breakfast hut. DBH is what we're going to call it. Now, Aaron and I have both been to Beth's before. It is one of the few 24-hour restaurants in town, but this was the first time that I'd been to Beth's in the light of day. And we came for one specific purpose, to order Beth's famous 12-egg omelet.
Hey, you guys ready?
We are ready. It's our first 12-egg omelet.
Nice.
Yes.
Which one do you want to do?
We're going to do kind of like a make-your-own. So ham and bacon, green onions, and what kind of cheese do you want?
Cheddar?
Cheddar.
Okay. And what kind of toast?
You said you make bread?
Yes.
Yes, we make all of our own bread except for the English muffins.
Sourdough.
Oh, thank you.
Can I have a decaf coffee too, please?
Yeah, I just made some.
Yeah, that's right. We're sharing the 12-egg omelet. You may say that that's cheating, but I say that it's common sense. This was a Monday morning. We had to go to work after this. Have you ever eaten 12 eggs stuffed with a bunch of non-kosher ingredients and then tried to work at your desk? So we were just trying to like keep it light, stay alive, conserve energy. I also want to point out one of my favorite things about the Beth's experience is that if you order a decaf coffee, the server puts a little plastic cat figurine next to your mug so that the staff knows that you're drinking decaf. Huh? Sorry. I mean decaf. I know. And speaking of puns, this was amazing. Aaron and I were joined by Chris Dalton, the owner of Beth's. He's been the owner for the past 16 years. And when Chris and I were emailing back and forth, just trying to set up this interview, I couldn't help but insert a few egg puns into the emails. So not long after we placed our orders, he pulls out a folded piece of paper from his pocket.
I actually have a list of them. So if you want to get into a...
Are you challenging me?
I doubt it. You do this journalism thing for a living. I think you probably kick my butt. But
I don't want to brag, but I competed in a world pun championship in Austin a few years ago. But I want to do this with you.
Oh, no.
Okay.
Well, that does sound exciting.
Ooh. Okay. So existentially speaking, is this your purpose in life?
I'm already flailing.
I win!
Exactly.
You know what? This is not a yoke. We have to take this very seriously.
Oh, God. Well, what do you expect?
I expect that Shell, if I can speak about myself, and would that be the second person, that she'll be winning this battle.
I have a feeling she'll be winning this, too. I'm not making any excuse.
Well, I don't want you to get embroiled in any sort of trouble.
All right, I'm floundering big time now.
It's not a fish punning. We're not punning about fish. No flounder allowed.
Yeah, I know. Sorry.
I think it's a draw. I think we both did an excellent job.
I think you're being kind. Thank you.
Chris says Beth's goes through over 500,000 eggs a year. Their omelets come in two sizes. You can get the teeny tiny dainty 6-egg omelet or the 12-egg omelet. And he estimates they sell about 25 12-eggers a day. That's compared to about 150 of the 6-egg omelets they serve daily.
All traditional breakfasts, including the omelets, does include all-you-can-eat hash browns. Most people, when it comes to the 12-egg omelet, though, they're not going to want more hash browns. We go through about a ton a week. We bring them in three times a week fresh, never frozen. And just we fill up our coolers, and by the time it's all said and done, it's about a ton every week.
One of my favorite parts of our morning at Beth's was getting to go behind the counter. I think there's something that you just feel kind of sneaky, like, ooh, I'm behind the scenes. But I got to hang out with Ben, who was the day cook, and he was managing the flat top grill.
Yeah, Millie, you have country coming soon?
Yeah, you got that.
Awesome.
Ben's hands were in constant motion. He's whisking eggs. He's pouring pancake batter on the flat top. He's smearing illegal amounts of butter onto just toasted English muffins. He's folding omelets, and then he's dealing with me. I have this huge, like, foot and a half long microphone that I've shoved in his face so he can describe the perfect hash browns.
Perfect hash browns should be, it should taste like potato chips on top and mashed potatoes on the bottom.
I watched Ben construct a massive, giant 12-egg omelet.
This is 12 eggs right here. And then, just put it down on the grill. Let it cook for just a little bit. Then I'm going to spread it out. Make sure that it's all even throughout.
So right now, this omelet, as it cooks, is like 2 feet across.
Just about. I'm gonna fold it and make it a little bit smaller.
So what's going into this omelet?
This is a making bacon omelet, so it's gonna be Swiss cheese, sour cream, and bacon and tomatoes.
Are you from the East Coast?
Yes, I am.
I'm here.
I'm from North Mass.
Oh, there it is. I got it now. Yeah.
North Mass Italian.
Chris says the most popular omelet on the menu is the triple bypass. Bacon, sausage, ham, double the Swiss cheese, and double the American cheese.
You know, Betts is known for down home, you know, earthy, you know, just good American breakfast. So we don't have spinach and feta and a lot of those ingredients, but we have all your basics. Ham, sausage, you know, cheddar, Swiss.
He says every now and then a customer will ask for every single ingredient in their omelet, which he warns them will cost about $40 and will weigh several pounds. So when Adam Richman from Man vs. Food came in, he ordered the Southwestern Exposure. This is an omelet full of chili, sour cream, salsa, and melted cheese.
Adam Richman couldn't finish his for two reasons. One, it was a Southwestern Exposure, again, the one with all the chili and everything in it, by far the heaviest omelet. And then they were moving the cameras or something, so they broke for a second. He took a big drink of Diet Coke and immediately kind of went, and he just went, oh, God, I know better than that. And he's like, I'm done. He goes, I can't. He's like, and I'm not going to get sick on national TV. Guess I can't blame him for that.
And then our omelet arrived on a big, round metal pizza pan because the plates at Betts are not big enough to withstand this omelet. Every omelet is served on top of a bed of hash browns with toast and freezer jam on the side.
Aaron is cutting the giant omelet down the middle. Your side looks bigger, much bigger. God.
Well, you know, you can have that piece. We can flip this thing right around.
No, thank you. Ooh, look at that one little strand of cheese. It's like a little bridge from your omelet to my omelet. The only thing keeping our friendship together.
I highly recommend you go to my Instagram page and see this omelet for yourself. I have to admit, it's not the most Instagram beautiful picture. It's just a big, giant, yellow square omelet. But it's Your Last Meal podcast. The photo doesn't do it justice. Let's talk about this omelet.
Oh, my God. So I've been going to Beth's for years now, right? And always I've been like, I'm going to take down this 12-egg omelet.
Yeah.
I felt very confident. No spoilers or anything, but it was a task.
Yeah.
Just to do half. So I don't know what kind of human monster can put down this whole thing. Beast more stomach than man.
I liked it, though. So honestly, I wasn't looking forward to eating the omelet because I never order them.
Yeah, you're not an omelet
person.
Not
an omelet person, because I have this image in my mind of omelets eaten when I was a child, of these very big, thick, almost like foamy omelets.
Mm.
And this is like paper thin. So it's just like a very thin, nice, light omelet that is stuffed with all the good stuff that you want to eat. So I really liked it. I did not have a hard time eating it until, well, that's not true. I had a hard time eating it. I didn't have a hard time starting it. I liked this omelet. All right, so we're off to the races, eating this 12-egg omelet. And while we do that, I'm going to give you a sheet of paper and a basket full of crayons, metaphorically, in the form of some egg knowledge. I was curious about why eggs became a breakfast food. Sure, we eat egg salad for lunch, and it's been trendy to put a fried egg on whatever you're having for dinner, but eggs are the most ubiquitous breakfast food. Seriously, try and find a breakfast menu in America that does not have eggs on it. So I called up Rachel Kong, author of the book All About Eggs. Rachel was actually my editor at Lucky Peach magazine, where I did a couple of freelance pieces. Lucky Peach was the most creative, beautiful, wild, sort of avant-garde food magazine that has ever existed, in my opinion, and it sadly folded last year. But Rachel Kong's still alive. She's still writing. So she was available to talk about why people around the world eat eggs for breakfast.
There are lots of different theories about it, but one of the main and most obvious reasons is that chickens lay eggs sort of in the morning and people harvest them in the morning. And that is why we eat eggs for breakfast, at least in the Western world. I think, you know, eggs are also a very protein rich, hearty meal. So I think for workers, they were just a great source of, you know, quick burst of energy, and eggs are sort of ubiquitous. People eat eggs pretty much everywhere, and the people who don't eat eggs, it's for religious or dietary reasons, right? But eggs are so universal, and chickens are universal, and every culture has these different versions of how they use boiled eggs, how they use fried eggs, and I think that the fact that you can find an egg anywhere makes it a great candidate for breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Here's Rachel reading an excerpt from All About Eggs to give us the history of eating breakfast in the West.
The ancient Romans ate breakfast, which they called integulum, and included eggs if available. And throughout the Middle Ages, Europeans ate two large meals in contrast to the Roman three. Physicians and religious leaders of the time suggested that it would be gluttonous to eat before dinner, and so breakfast was a meal reserved for children, the elderly, and manual laborers who needed energy first thing in the morning. It's in the 1800s that breakfast really takes off. The Industrial Revolution ushers in the need for workers, who in turn need heavy breakfasts, and the Second Industrial Revolution and the rise of the nouveau riche sees the creation of the full English, an egg-laden meal that can be dressed up, three-course breakfast spreads, or down, beans, toast, and an egg.
Oh my God, I wrote the word ubiquitous again. Should I just say it? Do you guys want to hear me say it again? I warned you at the beginning. Eggs are ubiquitous. Seriously. My birthday's in January. Get me a thesaurus. Eggs are found everywhere. They are the first thing that kids learn to cook a lot of the time, but they are also a wonder food. I can't think of another ingredient that can be used so many ways. Not only can you fry, scramble, poach, and make an omelet out of an egg, all producing very different textures and results, you can make sauces like hollandaise. You can treat eggs like a sauce in carbonara. You can take the whites and make fluffy meringue. You can bake cakes and brownies with them. You can make pasta dough with eggs. You can use them to bind things like meatballs and meatloaf. And if you fry an egg right with the perfectly runny yolk, it comes with its own little pool of sauce. I don't know if we'll get sued for saying the ad campaign they used to use, but it really is the incredible edible egg. Trademark. Copyright.
Big egg.
Big egg's coming for you. Okay, now that you're full of eggy knowledge, let's get back to our omelet challenge at Beth's Cafe.
Coming to you live with an update, I would say we're like 5 eggs in, maybe?
Yeah, I'd probably have about an egg left out of my 6. I'm starting to get the meat sweats.
Yeah, you do have a meat mustache right now.
A meat stash?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's fine. The only problem is, once we get back to the station, I'm going to be 100% worthless.
Yes.
Probably spend a couple minutes in the lavatory, not to get too behind the scenes.
I could finish this, like my stomach's not full, but when I get full, I start getting lethargic, uh-huh. And that's starting to happen. Like my vision is getting weird. So, yeah. I think I'm going to call it.
I'm going for a clean plate.
You are?
I'm proud of your effort.
Well, now that you said, okay, now I'm going to finish.
Well, let's go big or go home, right?
All right. I will be sad if you finish and I don't. I'm going to finish.
All right.
Okay.
I mean, I only had about 5 bites left. That's it. But then, 2 bites later.
Okay, it's been about a minute and a half, and I'm not doing it.
Oh, you're throwing in the towel already?
I'm throwing in because I just took a few more bites, and I was like, I'm not going to let my pride and competitive nature ruin my day. Otherwise, you're going to be so tired.
Well, Rachel, you're a better person than me because you're pointing a mic at my face and we're here to eat this thing and dagnabbit, I'm going to eat it.
Your face has totally changed.
I didn't want it anymore.
You're sitting there with this sour look on your face. You're like rubbing your eye.
I was thinking like, I'm tired of eating an omelet. Like if this turned into like a taco, then I could finish it. I need a variety. I don't want any more of the same thing. I've hit my limit. Nothing.
So Aaron Mason heroically swooped in and finished the last 3 bites of my omelet for me.
How important is it to keep a diner like this, like a classic greasy spoon? Where does that play a part in Seattle as it gets richer and richer?
Well, there just aren't that many classic greasy spoons left anymore. And the term greasy spoon, we wear that title proudly. We get named best greasy spoon pretty much every year for as long as I've been here. So, you know, I think it kind of, if you just say greasy spoon, I think people have a perception, biscuits and gravy and eggs and bacon and sausage. This is about as old school as you can get.
This podcast is called Your Last Meal. So you may be wondering what John Hodgman's last meal is. I owe you that, and you're going to get it after this break. We're back with the ever so thoughtful, witty, and wicked smart. I learned that from Ben the Day Cook. I feel like a real masshole right now. I don't know if I can say that, but I've been wanting to say it all week. Here's John Hodgman.
So let's talk about your last meal. If you had to choose, what would your last meal be?
Yeah, you know, I have to say this has been haunting me all afternoon as I've thought about it. It's a very grim proposition. Are you sentencing me to death?
Yeah, I am. Well, it sounds more grim than it is. The idea for me is just to make you think about what is the most important food to you, either most delicious or most sentimental. It just kind of gets wrapped up in the last meal thing, but you don't have to think of it as something morbid.
No, I appreciate that. And it's a great prompt for a conversation if you were talking to someone who is less morbid than I am. But as you mentioned, my book Vacation Land, True Stories from Painful Beaches, is out in paperback now, and it chronicles a lot of my time traveling through the state of Maine. It's called Vacation Land. That is the nickname for the state of Maine, which is sort of a cruel joke, because Maine is a cruel place. People who go for vacation don't realize that they're going to go to beaches where the water is so cold that it is made of hate and it wants to kill you, and the beaches themselves are made of rocks and knives. It is not a place that makes you feel like you deserve pleasure. In fact, it is a place where you go and contemplate the fact that nature is rugged and doesn't care whether you live or die, and is a wonderful place for a person from New England like me, who has reached middle age and started to think about mortality, can go and think about the end of all things and what foods you would want to eat. And
hold on, I'm booking my ticket to Maine. Sounds great.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It sounds nice.
It's great. Oh, yeah. If you're the kind of person who, on a basic level, believes you don't deserve happiness, Maine is a good place to go on vacation. But there is happiness in Maine, I will say. I mean, the honest answer, of course, is I would want my last meal to be with my wife and children. Anything I could eat with them, any time I could spend with them, is how I would want to spend that meal. But it would be even better, for example, if it were in Maine, specifically in the summertime, at sunset or maybe an hour or two before twilight, eating pizza at the Tinderhearth Bakery in Brooksville, Maine. And I'm sorry, people of Brooksville, I'm going to blow this spot up. So Tinderhearth is a bakery in an old farmhouse in the middle, truly, of nowhere on the Blue Hill Peninsula in Maine, a remoter part of that peninsula called Brooksville. It is in the middle of a bunch of rolling fields and farmland. And this part of the peninsula was reclaimed in the 70s by some very famous back-to-the-landers. There's a lot of really, really highly intense organic gardening going on in this area, and a lot of old hippies who started these farms. And Tinderhearth Bakery is kind of a part of this movement. As I say, it sits in this old farmhouse. They make the most incredible bread, and by they I mean the incredibly beautiful, almost luminous, tattooed young people who work by the fire and get this glow of health and youth upon them, because it's a wood-fired bakery. And all seem to be, I think, sleeping with each other. I think it's a little bit of a sex cult, but I'm not sure. In the summertime, twice a week, they make pizza, and they just serve it very unceremoniously in their backyard. And you call up in the morning, and you have to, you know, say, I want one or two or three, and I would never get less than three pizzas. There's a cheese, there's a meat, there's a veg. And you have to reserve it in the morning so that they can time it for when it comes out of the oven, because they can only make so many at a time. And then you go sit at a broken down, what you might call it, picnic table out in this beautiful garden and eat this pizza served to you by these elves. And you can bring along your own drink, or now that I think they have wine and beer there too. So that's probably where I would want to spend. I mean, you know, it's getting to be, as we record this, it's getting to be summer now. Even though I try not to eat too much bread in my life, that's what I'm looking forward to at this moment.
That sounds so dreamy, and it makes me think of like the Bon Appetit, or we have on the West Coast, the Sunset Magazine spreads, where it's the most beautiful, shiny, tan people, and you can't tell what ethnicity they are. They all have really cool outfits, and I just don't understand who these people are, and I want to be all of their friends.
Oh, you can tell what ethnicity these people are. They're all white. It's Maine. I mean, I don't want to...
They wouldn't make it into one of those shoots.
Make no mistake. These young people are all tan because they don't have any melanin in them.
So is it your country house that's in Maine? You're there part of the time?
Well, that is accurate, although it does make me seem like a true Thurston Howell III creep. but yes, we live in Brooklyn, New York, and we also own a home in rural coastal Maine.
Okay.
And this has been something that we're very lucky to have, and it is something that happened because my wife grew up going to Maine and has people in Maine, family, and basically, you know, informed me, you know, very early on into our marriage that wherever we lived, we would end up accepting our deaths in Maine. And so a house became available a few years ago, and real estate is relatively affordable there. And so we bit the bullet and we bought this home. And, you know, because my wife teaches high school and I am self-employed, whatever I am, we are able to spend huge chunks of the year up there. And eventually those will be all chunks of the year.
I saw that you're on some list that you're one of the 10 most intriguing Mainers, and I had never heard Mainer before, and so that just made me laugh. I was wondering.
Oh, I don't know where that list is, but that's very embarrassing. I mean, a Mainer is a real thing. It's a native Maine person, and that is not me. I am exactly the opposite of what a Mainer would consider to be a Mainer. I'm a native Massachusettsian. They hate us almost more than they hate themselves. I mean, it's a pretty flinty group of insider Yankees when you get to certain areas. And the truth is, a Mainer would really only be someone whose grandparents were born in Maine and you hadn't ever left. So that's nice that I'm on that list, but please don't spread it around. It's likely to get me murdered in the state of Maine.
Well, another headline that's even more embarrassing. This one's bad. This is the first thing that comes up. Minor celebrity John Hodgman is the main attraction.
Well, I have to take responsibility for minor celebrity because that's exactly what I am. I acknowledged that when my last book came out, and basically I signed it John Hodgman, famous minor television personality, which I feel is the most accurate way to describe what it is that I do. That said, that headline is terrible because they use Maine as a pun. And even though I am a weird dad, I'm not even going to make a dad joke like that.
No, I love puns, but I just feel like if you live in Maine, you can't make that Maine pun because it's been made so many times.
Yeah, it's a little on the nose.
Think of all the poor horses that have to deal with the Maine puns.
Good point. I hadn't even thought of it in those terms.
Yeah, I'm going to do a 5K for all the Maine horses so that we could raise money for them to leave Maine. John says he always orders all three pizzas at Tinder Hearth, whatever three they're serving that day. But if he could design his own pie...
For me, I like a sausage pizza. Like, it's like pepperoni plus. But I think pepperoni, I guess, is probably the default best slice of pizza. And sausage feels a little unctuous and over the top to me. So that's when I start to feel a little bit self-indulgent.
Pepperoni is the best. And it's taken me a long time to come back around because it's like you like pepperoni as a kid. And then I started getting fancy and I started getting into food. And then you switch to prosciutto and basil and right. All this and just margarita. And then now I come back around and pepperoni is so good, especially when you get the little cups that curl up and crisp around the edge. And they're like tiny hot tubs full of hot grease. That is the best.
Yeah, you know, this is street food. You know what I mean? You can fancy it up. But ultimately, you have to honor that it's simple pleasures, and pepperoni is that simple pleasure. Now, that said, I'm not going to turn my nose up at a white clam pie at Frank Pepe's in New Haven, which is, you know, one of the places people fight about whether that's where the pizza began. But white clam pie is a really special thing. If you can get it in New Haven, Connecticut, do it.
It is my dream to have that pizza. It hasn't happened yet, but it will. So going back really quickly to your last meal, is pizza an important food to you, or is it just that whole setting and everything that comes along with it, being outside with your family, being in that special place, having the pizza only made, you know, sometimes, and you have to get your order in early? Is that kind of more of the appeal of it?
Pizza is delicious, right? Everyone loves it. It is not a sandwich, by the way. That's another debate that I will not have at this time.
Okay.
I love pizza, but pizza, much like scrambled eggs, much like all the food we love, tends to be inexorably tied up in the context in which we sort of most and best enjoyed it. And as a person in his now late 40s, I can't be eating a lot of bread because I've become a big old fatso. So I can't eat a lot of pizza. So I tend to avoid it because for the most part, I consider it to be empty calories. I would say, you know, when I thought about my last meal, it was always in the context of context. You know, I love barbecue. I love barbecue brisket, but nothing is better than going and eating at Franklin Barbecue in Austin, Texas. You know, I love steak. And for me, I will always go to Keen's Chop House in New York City. But Keen's is a very special place to me because I had a lot of very important first meetings there. And they've got all these weird pipes on the ceiling. And they treat me nice. And I've been there enough that the context is, now includes the fact that they know that I want that Plymouth Gin Martini before I even walk in the door. So it is very much, you know, these meals are... they come in context, and they are woven into memory. And that's why talking about food is so compelling, right? Because it is a connection to family and history and culture and tradition, and written big and also in the very personal history that we have. And that's why it's valuable and not pointless to talk about food, whereas it is absolutely pointless to argue about whether a hot dog is a sandwich. Just enjoy yourselves, guys.
And that was John Hodgman's last meal. His latest book, Vacationland, is out in paperback now. Buy it from your most favorite or your least favorite bookseller. And listen to his podcast. It's called Judge John Hodgman, and I am newly addicted to it.
Can I just say, I've been a big fan of John Hodgman's for a very long time, and he's one of those guys, as you can tell, everything he does, he's great in. He always works with really great people. So if you see anything that John Hodgman is involved with, check it out if you liked him on this show, and you will love what he does.
Thanks to Chris Dalton and the entire staff at Beth Steiner for letting me get in the way and point my microphone at piles of hash browns, and for crafting us a delicious 12-egg omelet. Thanks to writer and editor Rachel Kong. You can pick up a copy of All About Eggs. It's full of excellent egg knowledge and 100 eggy recipes from around the world. And she wrote a novel last year called Goodbye Vitamin, which will be out in paperback soon. This episode was produced by Aaron Mason and me, theme music by Prom Queen. And you can see Prom Queen performing at the Can Can in Seattle this weekend all the way through October. She's in a show called Femme Fatale. She wrote all the music for it, and she'll perform in every show. You can follow us on Instagram. We're Your Last Meal Podcast for some behind-the-scenes stuff. And if you have a spare second, please give us a review on iTunes. It's kind of like a big old game of telephone. Help spread the word. I'm Rachel Bell, and until next time, this is Your Last Meal.